So the great problem with America is that it's empty. It's an empty country. It's not empty of people, of course. It certainly has plenty of people, though fewer people than it would have if not for abortion. It's not empty of things, you know, of shopping malls and fast food restaurants and cars and buildings and so on. It's filled with stuff and with people who use the stuff, but at the core of those people using the stuff, at their core, and thus at the core of America itself, is an emptiness, a boredom, an indifference, an apathy, a void. And this has become our nation's defining feature, that it is hollow, that there's nothing real inside of it. People are distracted, they are lost in the white noise of modern society. They are being consumed by the media they consume. The average American doesn't think beyond his appetites. He's like a child, but in the worst way. Can't think beyond what he wants right now. He doesn't search, and in this sense he's not like a child at all. But he doesn't search for truth, he doesn't desire joy. He settles for whatever cheap imitations of those things that he can find inside the glowing box he spends all day staring into. Now, if you want evidence of this emptiness, I think we could look first at the massacres and tragedies that we see on the news almost every week now. And it's often said that the perpetrators of these things, you know, the mass shootings, the school shootings and so on, it's often said that these people are hateful, that they're hateful, bigoted people. And we're so off the mark with that. We're still missing the point. They're not hateful at all. I wish they were. These monsters are not human enough to hate. They, you know, when you have hate inside you, that means at least you have something. It's a feeling. It's a conviction. Hate is just love turned upside down. But the killers have no hate. They have nothing. They are empty. And that's why the survivors of, you know, every mass shooting, it's always the same. You listen to the survivors, they tell the same story. It's never a story of a guy charging into the building, screaming, spittle coming out of his mouth, yelling, you know, getting his vengeance with anger in his eyes. It's never that. It's always just he's casual about it as he's spraying bullets. Dead eyes. He's got the facial expression of somebody, you know, at the DMV or checking the mail, just like he's not even interested in what he's doing. Like he could have done anything else that day, but it just so happened to be this. These people in this burst of violence, this last desperate attempt to feel something, and that's what this is, that's what lies at the root of all these killings. They're trying to feel something. And in so doing, they show us indifference brought all the way to the bottom, into total despair, into hell. Abortionists have the same bored, yawning approach to carnage, the same unhuman emptiness, as did the Nazi death camp operators, as was famously commented on at Nuremberg. They were recounting all the Jews they'd murdered, and they were just yawning about it, like they were talking about killing a mouse. The banality of evil, it was described, or we may call it the indifference of evil. I want to stay for just a moment on the shootings before we move on to abortion, because it's not just the attacks themselves that are so disturbing and that are evidence of this emptiness. The way that we react to them also shows our own emptiness, because we treat this stuff now like it's not even real, like these aren't even people who died. You know, we carry on as though we're living in a movie or something. So as soon as the bodies hit the ground, we go to our battle stations, we start politicizing, we start fighting amidst the corpses like vultures, and we start, you know, looking to blame the other side to score a point. Yay, I won a point on that one. The human casualties are props to us. We feel nothing for them. Everyone starts taking bets and they start wagering, oh, I bet it was this and that. They start betting about, you know, what is his skin color? What religion was he? What talk shows did he listen to? Who did he vote for? And each side is openly rooting for him to be one or the other. And then the winning side, when they find out, when the news comes out that he's XYZ, they're ecstatic. They can hardly contain their glee. But there's something so routine and lifeless and inhuman in this whole spectacle. And you think, is anyone even really angry about these killings anymore? Is anyone sad? Is anyone anything? Or is it just an excuse to bicker? Is it an excuse to just fling talking points at each other before we get bored with it and we can wait longingly for the next massacre to give us something to gossip about for a couple of days? So if you're wondering where all these killers are coming from, check Twitter. It's filled with future candidates, people who do not recognize the humanity in their fellow man. The internet is like a farm system of sociopaths because it detaches us from reality, from each other, and yet it allows us to interact with each other while not confronting and acknowledging the other person's personhood, which kind of reminds me of something else. And so you start to see this sociopathic indifference everywhere in our society, not just in the school shootings, not just on Twitter. I mean, there was a video recently of a bunch of teenagers who were laughing and taunting a man while he drowned in a lake. There was a case not long before that of several people who captured and tortured a disabled man for no reason whatsoever and filmed it for Facebook Live. Only a few weeks ago, a woman was beaten unconscious and left for dead on the sidewalk, and passersby stopped to take selfies with her body. Or think of the many cases where someone live streams their suicide and thousands of people watch and cheer it on. This is all evidence of our emptiness, total emptiness and apathy. But the greatest evidence, of course, is the 60 million babies who have been killed through abortion in our country since Roe v. Wade. It's not a coincidence, you know, that a lot of this stuff we're seeing, that we're seeing this happen now, after decades of the systematic slaughter of babies. Babies who are killed, of course, legally by human hands and a little, nondescript building in a shopping mall somewhere that folks drive by on their way to work or their way to Target or Applebee's. They don't even think about it. And these babies are killed at the behest of their own parents with the help of so-called doctors facilitated by the government, and in response to their silent screams, all there has been from many corners of our culture is a giant yawn. Abortion, I think, is not only the most terrible product of this cultural emptiness I'm talking about, but also one of the primary things causing it. We have abortion because we're empty. We're empty because we have abortion. After so many decades of legal infanticide, we've now arrived at a point where our society, many people in our society at least, really do not see the beauty and sacredness of human life. They just don't see it anymore. This is one of the things that used to be we would consider human nature. Everyone can see it. But abortion has this unique power not only to feed off of our cultural indifference, but to fuel it. And so we ask how. I think in two ways. First, because, as we know, abortion dehumanizes, you know, not a certain religion or a certain race or a certain ethnicity, which many cultures throughout history have done terribly and tragically, but it dehumanizes an entire stage of human development. It says that humans at a certain point are worth nothing, which means, logically, of course, human beings inherently have no worth. They cannot possess value inherently by their nature if they once possessed their nature yet possessed no value. Inherent value can't be acquired by degrees over time. You either have it or you don't. You know, the way that I try to explain it to people, maybe you've used a similar image, but you know, always bring it back to the person themselves. And so I'll say to him, okay, take yourself in your current form. Now rewind back to yesterday. Was that still you? Did you still have value? Now go back a year ago. Still you? Yeah. 10 years ago? Think back to kindergarten. Go back to your first birthday. Go back to when you were 6 months old. Keep following your own timeline all the way back, back, back. Rewind the tape, rewind the tape. Okay, stop right there at that very moment when you emerge from your mother's birth canal. Is that still you? Yes. Are you worth something? Yes. Okay, now rewind it back just 1 second. Is it still you? Of course it is. It couldn't be anyone else. You were you from the moment you first existed, from the moment you were a being. And if you had no value then you have no value now. So by removing value from the child, we remove value from all people. And nobody wants to admit this, of course, explicitly, and few ever will, but I do believe that a great many people have implicitly adopted this idea. They've just kind of accepted it. They've absorbed it without really realizing it. So they have in the back of their minds this idea that human life has no real value or meaning. Second thing we have to think about is the particular victims we've chosen here, which are children. The most innocent, the most pure, the most beautiful of all people are the precise ones we have targeted for extinction. You know, you'd think if you were had no knowledge of abortion or anything, you were living in a cave and you were to write a horror movie about a society that decided to start wiping people out, you'd think they'd start with adults. You know, people like you and I. Because adults can be cruel, selfish, old, ugly. Many of them have already wasted their potential. Their beauty and purity has rotted away after decades spent abusing themselves and those around them. Adults can be unloving, selfish, obnoxious. It would be wrong, of course, to start aborting adults, but at least we have a sinfulness to us. We have an ugliness. Something that you can point to and say, yeah, because of that, that's why we need to get rid of these people. Of children? They've committed no sin. They've harmed no one. They are filled to the brim with joy and potential and love. If we can't see the value and worth of a child, then who can we see it in? And the thing is, even if I agreed that the fetus is merely the fetus, quote unquote, is merely a potential human, even if I agreed with that, which, of course, I do not. But just to illustrate how bad the pro-abortion arguments are, even if I agreed with that, let's say I did. Okay, it's a fetus, quote unquote, it's a potential human, not a human. Wouldn't you still treat this potential human like it's the most valuable thing on the planet? I mean, this is a crude analogy, it doesn't totally work, but what if you had a winning lottery ticket? You know, what if you won $50 million with your lottery ticket and you were on the way? You know, imagine a pro-abortion person winning $50 million lottery tickets, got in his hand, he's going there to the lottery office to cash it in. He doesn't have $50 million in his hand right now. It's just a piece of paper. It's just the potential for $50 million. But I'm betting that if I ran up and grabbed that ticket and tore it up and threw it in the sewer, they would react like I had just stolen $50 million from them. Not like I had just stolen a piece of paper. Because whether that ticket is $50 million or merely the potential to become $50 million very soon, it's basically irrelevant. At least it's irrelevant to the point of whether or not we should destroy it. Now, as it happens, the child in this analogy is already, from the moment of conception, much more than $50 million. He is a being of infinite value. But what I'm trying to say is that the pro-abortion argument fails even on its own terms. Even if I agreed with how they framed the argument and I said, yeah, it's a potential human, I could give you that. I mean, I could, that's a huge cavernous leap that I could, let's say I let you make that leap. You've still got another huge cavern to get over to get to the point where, okay, it's a potential human. Now over here is, let's kill it. So I can give you the first leap, but you, the next leap is on your, you're on your own on that one. And the interesting thing is that, you know, whether we're talking about potential value or whether we're talking about potential value or value or whatever, the fact is we all seem to agree that a child is potential, has potential. Whereas every adult represents some degree of squandered potential. So if children are not worth defending, if their potential is not worth protecting and fostering, then what about us? I think in going after the most innocent, the most precious, we have as a culture by necessity been forced to disassociate ourselves from the horror. You know, it's like a person who suffers a great trauma, develops a personality disorder, where they're removing themselves from what they've witnessed because they cannot face it. And that's what we've done as a society. It's a nightmare too terrifying to face, so we box it out of our minds. And the more we keep it boxed out, the more we run from it, the further into the darkness we wander, until we are so deep into the darkness that we prefer it to the light. So the average person, in fact, I'll talk now about the average pro-lifer. The average pro-lifer is basically a fraud. The average pro-lifer refuses to see a nightmare, I'm talking about the average person. You go up on the street and you say, are you pro-life? Yeah. For the average person who identifies himself as pro-life, it's just that. It's just a word. He doesn't see a nightmare. He doesn't see a horror. He doesn't see a Holocaust. In fact, he'd probably caution you against using language like that. He sees an issue, political issue. One that he feels a certain way about, mildly. He has his position on the subject. He'll defend it unconvincingly for a moment when the conversation turns to that subject, but then he'll stop talking about it when it leaves. And the average pro-lifer is, in this way, quite similar to the average Christian. And they are one and the same much of the time. The average Christian in America is a Christian incidentally. He is an incidental Christian. He fits Christ into whatever little crevice or corner of his life he can find. Something that, you know, he finds a place that isn't currently occupied by somebody. He stuffs it into a corner there with, you know, where there's an old broomstick and like a fishing pole and cobwebs. And he just shoves them there. Christ is to him, you know, much like a board game or something that someone gives you for Christmas. And you say, oh, wow, that's nice. We'll definitely play it. And then you put it up on the shelf and you forget about it until next Christmas and they come visit. And so he has Christ up there on the shelf alongside his pro-life convictions, you know, looking nice and neat. He still says he's a Christian. And that's why we can look at the census and we can look at the surveys and we can see that America is 70% Christian. Wow. I mean, that's great. 70% of America is a Christian. 50% of America is pro-life. Of course, that leaves 20% who are Christian and explicitly pro-abortion. But you look at that and you think, well, if you didn't know any better, you'd imagine a culture quite a bit different from our own. But those numbers are meaningless. Most of these people are Christian for about 90 minutes a year, pro-life even less frequently. I'm not saying they're bad people. They aren't necessarily willful liars. Their Christianity is just fraudulent. Their pro-life convictions are hollow, but they don't know it because they're too apathetic to examine even their own beliefs. And so this, the apathy, is our great enemy right now in the pro-life movement, I believe. And so I confess that I am often accused of being harsh. I know it surprises you to hear that. Rude, abrasive, divisive, controversial, angry, scary, horrible, mean. I could go on for hours. And I'm accused of this very often by my fellow pro-lifers in the movement. It's one of the reasons why I'm often invited to speak at banquets and then uninvited after they talk to the board. Boards don't like me, I've discovered. And, you know, people say, well, you're never going to convince the other side when you talk like that. I got two responses to that. Number one, you're not convincing the other side either. Number two, here's the secret. I'm not just trying to convince the other side. I'm trying to convince our side. We live in a country right now where we need to preach to the choir. The choir needs to be converted. What we need to do is break through the white noise and get their attention and cut through the boredom and the apathy and scream to them and say, hey, look at this. Look what's going on. Are you on our side or not? That's what we need to do. This is what I think many of us miss. We have to mobilize and motivate our own troops before we can hope to win any battles against the other side. You know, a recruiter and a drill sergeant are two very different jobs in the military. An army needs both. Problem with the pro-life movement is we got a bunch of recruiters of varying levels of effectiveness. Don't have a lot of drill sergeants. And that's unfortunate because we are truly fighting a war against the darkest evil the world has ever seen. So we can go out there and convince people and they'll say, yeah, sure, I agree intellectually with everything you're saying about pro-life being pro-life. And then they just go sit back down on the couch. And that's when we need to come back and say, hey, bud, get up. We need to see that this is a war. We need to speak about it in those terms. Or else people will be tempted to see it as nothing more than a discussion, a debate, an interesting thing to talk about. And of course, the only thing worse, more challenging, I should say, for us than the apathetic pro-lifer is the apathetic pro-abort. And I would submit that we have almost no chance of reaching them until we've converted almost all the apathetic pro-lifers. Because the chasm between, you know, us and them is so deep, we're going to need a lot of help. But the problem with these people is they have bought into the lie, but not with passion, not with vigor, not with applying any real thought to it. They just let themselves kind of drift into it, like a piece of wood in a river. They're pro-abortion not because they really believe in abortion, but just because they don't care that much about babies. This is the argument, by the way, this is the argument of the abortion industry. This is what they want. They're not really trying to rally the troops. Their argument is, stop caring. It's none of your business, just don't care. That's their rallying cry to most of society is, these women are doing what they're doing, just don't care about it. That's all, just stop caring. It's none of your business. And they're successful, and so we have a lot of people who, you know, don't even care enough to decide whether the baby is a baby. So you try to engage them in a discussion of personhood, and maybe they'll engage for a couple minutes, and then they'll say, yeah, I mean, whatever, sure, maybe it is a baby. Anyway, they haven't changed their mind. They didn't care that much about that argument. So trying to debate them is like wrestling a slug or something. They just slip and slide and change positions on a dime, and you're trying to get a hold of them. But they make 10 different arguments that all conflict with each other. And the conversation just ends and nobody wins. Nobody gets anywhere. Which is why I say, you know, give me the passionate pro-abortion person. I'll take that person. Give me someone who's angry and spiteful and vicious. Give me hate over boredom any day of the week. Give me someone who would spit in my face over someone who would yawn in my face. As I said, hatred is just love flipped over. All we got to do is set it right. But indifference is the real problem. Indifference is the absence of love. Indifference is an absence. And so there's nothing to hold on to, nothing to grip, nothing to set right. Hatred is not the worst thing. Emptiness, apathy, indifference, these are the worst things, and our culture is filled with them. Rather, I should say, our culture is not filled with anything. It has, in the middle, a giant hole. And that is why we, as pro-lifers, are not tasked with the job of climbing mountains or conquering fortresses. We are plunging into the void. We are trekking into an abyss. We are trying to fill a hole. But how do we do that? Well, I don't have all the answers or even most of the answers, but I have three ideas as to how we might engage this empty, apathetic culture. You know, just three basic strategies that I'd just like to briefly share with you. The first, I think, is really important. We have to use honest language. So there are some pro-lifers who say that we shouldn't call abortion baby murder. We shouldn't call pro-abortion people pro-abortion. We certainly shouldn't call them pro-baby murder. Shouldn't use words like slaughter and butcher. We should, they say, adopt the language that the pro-abortion side has assigned to us. We should be cooperative. Let them set the tone and the language and give it to us, and we will very cooperatively go along with it, and then they'll be so impressed with our civility that they'll change their minds. In other words, what we're saying is, let's help them cover their evil deeds under a layer of euphemisms. I think that's nonsense. And I know that different occasions call for different approaches. A sidewalk counselor is not going to approach a woman with words like these. They're only going to stir up fear and anxiety, and fear and anxiety are exactly what the baby killers in the clinic want. Because that's the two-pronged approach of the abortion industry. It is to instill apathy and indifference, a mind-your-business mentality in the culture at large, and in these women who walk in the door, it is to make them afraid for their very lives. But they've got nobody to turn to because everyone is just yawning and disinterested. That's how the abortion industry has engineered it. So when talking to a woman who's about to walk into a clinic, we use different language. We use more gentle language, and we need gentle people for that, and God bless those people and their ministry. But the national conversation about abortion cannot be had in the tone and using the language of a sidewalk counselor. Because the vast, vast majority of people we're engaging with are not about to have abortions. They may never have an abortion. A lot of them are men. And what do they want? They just want to live in peace and not be forced to confront the horror of this Holocaust. That's all they want. We have to take that peace from them. They have no right to it. They have no right to live in peace. Nobody has a right to live in peace and comfort if it is a peace and comfort bought by ignoring the children whose blood soaks the ground under their feet. Nobody has a right to hide from it. So that's why when generally discussing this issue, I believe we call it baby murder because it is baby murder. If you don't like the word, well, then maybe we should stop doing it. We call it butchery and slaughter because it is butchery and slaughter. We call them pro-abortion because they are pro-abortion. We speak the truth plain as day. If anyone is disturbed by it, good. If anyone is upset, good. If it makes their tummies hurt, good. It should. We've got this idea that the worst thing we could ever do to a person is make them uncomfortable. No, in our country, we're in our comfort, we're all just floating into oblivion. I think the most merciful thing, the most beautiful thing, the most loving thing we can do for someone is make them uncomfortable. Because the comfort is literally killing us and our babies. Number two, we have to be uncompromising. And I think in this case, the pro-life movement should take a page from a playbook that it perhaps has not thought to open, and that is the pro-life movement should, in this sense, be more like the gun rights movement, in my opinion. Have you ever noticed that every attack on the gun rights movement fails? Every attack on gun rights fails, no matter what. It always fails. They always lose. Every attempt to pass anti-gun legislation on a federal level, no matter how many tragedies occurred, how many times, you know, the anti-gun people are able to use these tragedies and hurl them against the pro-Second Amendment crowd, it never works. What a sad contrast between them and the pro-lifers, where we are left begging for crumbs, and we don't even get the crumbs. We're left just saying, okay, fine, but can you at least stop giving $500 million a year to Planned Parenthood? And we don't even get that. Now, the gun rights people have advantages that we don't have. They don't have anything like Roe to contend with, of course, first of all. Also, they're not fighting for something that requires others to make a sacrifice, and that's a big part of this. You know, when we fight for these children, we are asking and demanding that society and parents make sacrifices for those children. Our message is quite unmistakably, whether we phrase it this way or not, you have a duty to that child. You have a duty to him. That's what we're saying to the parents. And that's a tough sell in our narcissistic society. But still, I think the uncompromising attitude is a good lesson, a good model to follow. And that's why we can't support things like, you know, rape and incest exceptions that were mentioned before. Because when we do that, we undermine the seriousness of our own position. This is what the gun rights people have figured out. What they're saying is, we believe in gun rights, so no, we can't let you ban any kind of gun at all. Because then we've begun to say that, okay, maybe sometimes. And once we've done that, we start to lose. The only way to convince people, you know, our position is that babies are being killed and it's wrong to kill babies. The only way to convince people of both propositions is to be very clear that it's never okay to kill any baby at any stage, ever, under any circumstances, period. Now, if we allow for any exception, if we allow for a compromise, we have said, well, okay, maybe it's a little less bad in that case. And then people go back to tuning us out. The third thing is to pray. Now, I know we tend to think it's kind of ridiculous and cheap to suggest prayer as a solution. But that's only because our faith is ridiculous and cheap. If our faith is strong and real and vibrant, we know that only God can stir people out of this apathy. He's the only one who can wake us from our cultural coma. And so we must get on our knees and beg him. Beg him. I've been a hypocrite about prayer for a long time. I've always believed in it, and I've said so, but my own prayer life for a long time was ridiculous and cheap. And so was my faith. My prayer was rote. My prayer was self-interested. My prayer was covering the bases so I could get back to, you know, the real world. But I began to see the error of my ways, or God showed them to me, and finally I looked. And I realized that we're all in, a battle against Satan himself. So not only for the sake of the innocent, but for our own sake, we have to cover ourselves in prayer. We have to cling to God. Because it is a dangerous thing to go up against the forces of darkness by yourself. If you speak truth in our culture, the legions of hell will come after you. They will grab at your ankles and they will drag you into the pit if they can. All of the apathetic people, the comfortable people who are just walking along, Satan leaves them alone. Satan's message to his legions and his demons is very clear. If somebody's going to hell on their own, don't interfere. In fact, walk in front of them and pave out the road and, you know, have little cups ready for them, refreshments. Make it as easy as possible. But once you start walking the other way, and Satan gets the idea that he's losing his grip on you, that's when he panics. And as I began to see this, I fell to my knees in prayer, and I got deeper and deeper into my own prayer life. And so I always wanted, you know, just, I'm sort of so excited about the power of prayer that I just want people to know about it and to try it. And I found after a while that when I started praying more and more, that it wasn't a chore anymore. And so I look forward to, you know, praying the rosary every day, praying in the morning, praying in the afternoon, pray at night, pray throughout the day. Pray when you're in the car. Like, people walk, drive by, they think you're talking to yourself, you know? When Jesus was confronted by the devil in the desert during his temptation, what did he do? He quoted scripture. Have we ever stopped to think about this scene? The temptation, that, I mean, the whole scene is, you could spend, I'm sure, books, many books have been written about it. Spend your whole life studying it, never get to the bottom of it. It's an incredible scene. The Son of God going out into the desert in order to be tempted. Let's make no mistake about it. That's why he went out there. He was calling the devil out and saying, okay, Satan, do your worst. And in fact, he starved himself first for 40 days. Put one hand behind his back. He had one hand tied behind his back. Said, come on, Satan. Now's your time. And so Satan came out, and of course, when we're tempted, our temptation is internal. The Son of God cannot be tempted that way, because Satan and evil enters us through the cracks in our soul, which are sin. The Son of God has no sin, no cracks. So all evil can do is just come up against him physically and bounce off of him. But Satan tried. He had three temptations, and in response to every single one, Jesus quotes scripture. He wasn't doing that for himself. I mean, he could have just swatted Satan like a fly and said, get out of here. What are you doing? You know, swatted him halfway across the continent if he wanted to. But he was showing us. He was saying, even if I am going to use the Bible and prayer as a shield against the devil, what chance do you have facing him alone? And that is why a pro-life movement without God firmly in the center of it will lose. Lose. We see that we are not simply battling against the abortion industry, against so-called pro-choicers or Democrats or the media or Hollywood. They're only foot soldiers. They're just grunts in this thing. Our fight is against fallen angels. We are locked in a struggle with evil itself. And to be pro-life is to walk right up to the gates of hell. And that's where we stand. There's no place for apathy here. There's no place for indifference. We are face to face with the devil. He is in this room right now, looking at each and every one of us and our children and plotting our demise. Because he hates you for being here and he hates what you're doing. And so he's made you into a special project, along with your spouse and your children too. This is not a game. The legions of darkness hate us. And they want to eat us in hell for eternity. Abortion is not a war against human life. It is a war against God. Our culture cannot kill God, so it kills the closest thing to him that it can find, which is a child. There's precedent for that. When King Herod heard that the child Jesus had been born, he was so desperate to kill him that he sent his soldiers out to murder every baby boy in the country. He killed every baby boy in the country in a desperate mission to kill God. And we're doing the same thing. And for the same reason. Herod wanted to be king. We want to be the kings of our own existence. What can we do then as we stand in the midst of this supernatural struggle but hold on to God? What can we do but walk beside Christ and the armies of heaven? What can we do but cling desperately to our Lord and just forge ahead without fear, knowing that he is with us and we don't fight alone? And he's not sending us out to be destroyed. He's sending us out to victory. Now, thank you. Now, I did have one other thing I wanted to, in fact, originally that was going to be the end of the speech. And maybe you probably wish that I would just stop now. But for some reason, as I was driving here in a state of half delirium from the food poisoning, I started rewriting some of the speech in my head. And I thought of a story that I wanted to relate because I've talked a lot about the apathy and indifference in our culture. And so I'd like to give an example of the opposite, maybe something that we can hold on to as we leave here, a little bit of inspiration. And for that example, I turned to a man named Thomas Vanderwoody. Name probably doesn't mean anything to a lot of you, but hopefully after you hear his story, it will mean quite a lot. Thomas Vanderwoody lived on a farm in Virginia where he and his wife raised their seven boys. And one day, Thomas and his youngest boy, Joseph, Josie as his family called him, they're working out in the yard together. Josie has Down syndrome. And he and his father are basically inseparable. They did everything together. But on that fateful day in the fall of 2008, Josie stepped onto the cover of a septic tank, and the cover broke, and he fell in. The tank was 8 feet deep and entirely filled with sewage. So Tom ran over and tried to pull him out, but he couldn't. The boy was panicking and couldn't get a hold of him. So Tom didn't think twice. He jumped right down there into the filth and the muck and the dark. And he maneuvered himself under his son. He submerged himself in the filth and pushed Josie up with his body so that his son's head was above the sewage and he could breathe. But this meant that Tom could not breathe. He gave his breath to his son. 15 or 20 minutes later, paramedics arrived, pulled both of them out. Josie survived. Tom was dead. He suffered an unthinkable death, an agonizing death, the worst death anyone can imagine. A death he freely accepted and must have known he was getting himself into so that his son might live. These unborn children are dying in a sewage, in a filth, in a darkness of their own. And as I think about them in that whole drowning, I imagine the different sorts of people who pass by. And first you have the people who come upon the scene and they react with satanic enthusiasm. They pull up a chair and they take out the popcorn and they watch it and they cheer as the children sink to the bottom. Then there are the others who come up to the hole and they nod in approval. But they don't have the stomach to look at it, so they just keep walking. Then there are the mass of people, the indifferent, the apathetic, who just kind of yawn and step over the hole. Pretend there is no hole. They say, what hole? What children? I don't know what you're talking about. Then there are the mass of pro-lifers who see the children in the hole, feel genuinely distressed by it, so they get very upset. They start shouting nice slogans, and they reach out their hand, and when that doesn't work, they shake their heads mournfully, and they walk away, and they say, isn't that a shame? But we must be the Tom Vanderwoodies. We must be the ones who run and dive in and plunge ourselves into the ungodly slime and grab a hold of these children as best we can and lift them up to the light. We cannot save them all. We can't even save most of them. And many more will die, perhaps millions more. They're going to drown down there. But we can be down there with them, shining a light, shining love in the filth, in the refuse. That's our calling, to be the opposite of indifferent, the antidote to it, the answer. While the world looks on in disinterest, we have to be down there in the dregs, giving our whole lives and our whole selves to the cause of life and truth. Tom Vanderwoody did not die in sewage. He died in love. He died in a state of perfect self-giving love. Love brought to its fullness, to its conclusion, to its point. And it's with that same love, that same faith, that same trust in God that we have to leap down into that hell, that darkness, where at least we can ensure that a glimmer of light will still shine. Thanks, everybody.